Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Charles A.S. Hall, a leading figure in the biophysical economics field, an antidote to neoclassical economics and academic economics. Charles has authored 14 books and 300 scientific papers, taught at Cornell, the University of Montana, and the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry at Syracuse. He's an all-around great guy, and he is now retired, living in western Montana with his wife and dog and his fly rod. And we're very glad to have him on board this morning, and let's get ripping with it.
So I'm here with Charlie Hall. He's actually not with me. He's over in Montana, out on Flathead Lake, and I'm here in upstate New York, and we're going to have a little talk about biophysical economics, a field that Charlie Hall is one of the pioneers in. And for many years, he ran the ongoing Biophysical Institute program out of the State University of New York program at Syracuse. And it's a pleasure to have you here, Charlie.
Okay. Hi, everybody.
Charles, 2020 has been a year of trauma and wonders. What do you make of the present state of the economy in the United States?
The differences between the rich and poor have been enhanced. The ability of our system to recompense for that paralyzed. Whether they should or not, I guess people might argue about that. I think there should be much more than there has been, but that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. The virus was inevitable. We're lucky that we dodged the bullet, that it wasn't a big one. I mean, you know, not too many people are killed from it. I mean, far too many, but I don't think that we much more than doubled the rate of mortality at worst that we would have otherwise, and maybe not even that. And so it certainly has tumbled things upside down, and our oil production went way down, and now it had been at, I think, a peak, thanks to, if you want to use the word, fracking.
Yeah.
And we might talk about that briefly.
We are definitely going to talk about that.
All right, good. And so what do I think about it? The same thing other people think about it. We're hammered. Now, what's the good of this? I don't know. The CO2 production is probably less. That might be good for the climate, but the climate's certainly hammering us this year. Mm-hmm. So I probably look at it pretty much like all of your listeners. Wow, what the hell is going on? Well, all kinds of things are going on, many of which are predictable and some of which are not. And the net effect is A, some pretty rough sledding, but B, I do think that our economy has a great capacity for recovery, and in what ways and whether that's a good or a bad thing is a little bit more complicated question.
Yeah, I think we'll get to that too. I'd like to inform the listeners exactly what biophysical economics is and how it differs from what we take to be normal academic economics. I think you and I would agree that we exist in an economy based on energy, and that money is not energy. It may be a claim on energy or a claim on future energy, but can you describe exactly how biophysical economics differs from the standard thing? Can you describe the misunderstandings that exist over that?
First of all, I was trained in the natural sciences, in chemistry and physics and biology, ecology, geology and hydrology and meteorology and all of those ologies. And I had no courses in economics. And at one point in my life when I was a young professor at Cornell University, and I was trained as an ecologist, as a systems ecologist, and I had a fantastic teacher for my PhD, Howard Odom, who's a systems ecologist, that is looking at how entire ecosystems or systems of man and nature or humans and nature, how they operate, not just one species at a time or one individual at a time. So I was a modeler at the time, And I was especially interested in fish migration, which will probably come up later. But I was dissatisfied with most of the models in ecology because people were more enchanted with the mathematics than in the biological reality that underlay the process that they were trying to model. So I tried to build my models as an ecologist based more and more on the natural sciences and not on mathematics. And I got so dispirited by so much of what was going on in ecology that I switched in my mind. I said, well, since ecologists don't call the shots anyway, and since economists do, I'm going to take time out, and I took 7 years out to do this, and study economics. Because, you know, they get Nobel Prizes, and there's a lot more of them, and they must be smarter and have better standards. I was just looking for some place to anchor my science-based interest in modeling. Mm-hmm. And so what was astonishing to me is I found that economics was much worse than ecology. It was a disaster. It was based on models that were completely uprooted from reality. In a sense, as I learned later from my good colleague, Kent Klitgaard, who's an economic historian, this was not always the case for economists. The earlier economists, going back to the French physiocrats and Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and even Karl Marx, were focused much more on real systems. Where does wealth come from? The physiocrats said, well, it comes from the soil. And the classical economists, Adam Smith et al., felt that it came from labor and so forth. But something happened called the Marginal Revolution in the 1880s, where economics went from being called political philosophy, I think it was called, to modern economics, which is entirely based on the concept of satisfying human desires in the market. And it became a social science. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that they left all the natural sciences behind. Mm-hmm. And so biophysical economics attempts to re-inject the natural sciences into the questions usually asked by economists. And to make sure that the things that you do in economics, the theories and the ideas and so forth, are consistent with what we call biophysical, meaning natural world, reality. And so we worked very hard on that, and we published a paper, a cover article of Science magazine in 1984, called A Biophysical Economic Analysis of the United States, and found out all kinds of things that conventional economics was not answering, we could answer easily using the natural sciences. And that is the foundation of what we call biophysical economics today. We have an international membership of hundreds and maybe even 1,000 people that are terribly interested in this, all kinds of people from the financial world who are dissatisfied in their own way with economics, have come to us to seeking further information about this and so forth. But boy, we haven't cracked the door with conventional economics. They've circled the wagons. They're being attacked for other reasons too. So they circle the wagons and stay together and do their thing.
There's an awful lot going on in economics and finance that appears to be rather reckless and dangerous, and I suppose they feel that they're under attack, as well they should. Let's talk about energy. The most important kind of energy, as far as the United States is concerned, is oil production, really, because so many things depend on oil. There are ground transportation, aviation, just moving stuff around.
Let's
moving
not forget the sun. The sun is what feeds us and runs a water cycle and
we're not gonna forget it, but we're gonna put it aside for a moment.
Okay, the most important industrial energy, let's call it industrial energy,
sure,
versus natural energy is indeed oil. Yes, indeed.
We did this shale oil miracle thing, which I would actually describe as kind of a magnificent financial stunt, since it was enabled by a tremendous amount of debt generation, of debts that are now going to be very hard to pay back. And it didn't make a whole lot of money for the producers. And because of that, they can't get new loans to continue their operations. And what with that and the COVID-19 demand destruction, we have oil production going from that magnificent high of 13 million barrels a day at the end of 2019 to around 10 million today. So we've dropped, you know, quite a bit, millions of barrels a day in production. What is that telling you about where we're going, where the economy is going, and where the shale industry, the shale oil or oil industry generally is going?
First of all, I would say don't predict the death of the oil industry too soon. It's too important to us.
Okay.
Second thing is that it is true. I don't know how much people understand how much oil, the shale oil saved our ass. And it cost the people who invested in it. The investors lost $80 billion or more dollars, according to Art Berman, and he knows. Huge costs. And I wrote an article that was in The Hill that says that Donald Trump has to thank the people who are losing their shirts by investing in shale oil, because they're keeping the ship afloat, the economic ship afloat. Oil was half the price during the first 3 years of the Trump administration that it was at that time in Europe or that it was in the Obama administration. So oil was cheap. And that made the economy work well, and everything looked rosy until the COVID came along. And all of this was paid for by the people who were losing money, the investors who were losing money in investing in shale oil. So it's a kind of interesting little parallel. I think that the abundance and price of oil has a lot more to say about our economic history than most people give it credit for, although some people like Hamilton, he understands it very well. I mean, the people who do the statistical analysis do. So the critical thing, Jim, is that, as Gail Terberg has worked out, our economy needs oil that's expensive enough so people will go get it when it's getting harder and harder to get because we've used up all the easy oil. And yet, if it's too expensive, the economy can't stomach it.
So yeah, let me interrupt you for a second.
Yeah.
I think the basic formula, which I've repeated more than once for our listeners, is that oil at about $75 in today's dollars tends to crush economies, and oil under $75 a barrel tends to crush the oil companies. So it's a kind of a conundrum.
Well, so we were lucky that these investors were willing to lose their shirts and subsidize cheap oil, which made our economy look great, made it look better than in fact it was. I think oil is so valuable for the economy. Got to be careful here. I'm not recommending, therefore, we should pump more and more oil. That's a different question. But oil is indeed so important for our economy that it's probably worthwhile the government subsidizing it at $100 a barrel, because they'll get more than that back from the taxes on the oil, because $100 barrel of oil invested in the economy will generate something like $1,200, $1,500 worth of economic activity.
So in a way, what you're describing is a form of nationalization. It's not direct nationalization in the sense of the government operating the oil wells, but they are participating in a way.
They do subsidize it, but they subsidize all kinds of things, but sure. They do subsidize it. They could afford, according to my calculations, they could afford to subsidize it a lot more because oil is so useful in our economy. And people who are looking for a green future, and bless them, we all want to get there, but you've got to recognize how incredibly important oil has been and is at this moment and in the future. Well, it depends on how we build our economy, I guess.
Can we run all of our American stuff on alt energy, you know, suburbia, the military, the interstate highways, mass motoring, Walmart, moving tremendous amount of goods around
well,
on
I think
trucks.
You should put it more basically, Jim. Can we feed ourselves?
Well, yeah. So why don't you try answering some of those questions?
That the average calorie of food on your plate takes something like 10 calories of oil to grow it and to harvest it and to process it and to distribute it and to cook it and everything else to do. I often give an example. If you buy a bagel in New York City, a good bagel now, might cost you a dollar, I guess, these days.
Probably two or three.
Maybe two or three. Now, I consider money to be a lien on energy. That's how we keep track of our energy use and other things in our economy. So if you pay a dollar or if you make a bagel in anticipation that somebody is going to give you a dollar or two or three for it, now, I'm not including the cream cheese and lox, Jim, just
okay,
the bagel.
Understood.
That might still be a dollar. I don't know. So that means that somebody in anticipation of that is going to take natural gas in Louisiana and make nitrogen fertilizer, and then they're going to barge it up the Mississippi River to Nebraska, load it in a truck or a train and take it to where the fields are and put it into a machine and drag by a tractor and spread this nitrogen fertilizer on the field. And then they're going to take tractors out and cultivate it and plant the wheat and all the stuff that they do. And then later in the year, they're going to go and they're going to harvest the wheat and grind it up into flour, put it in bags, put it on a railroad, all of this taking energy at every single step, oil usually, and then putting it on a train and shipping it back east. And then the baker is going to, a truck's going to deliver the flour to his shop, and he's going to use an electric mixer to mix up the flour. And then he's going to use either electricity or natural gas or something to heat the oven and boil the water. And then he's going to make this delicious bagel. And so when you go and you pay a dollar, what you're really paying is 6 megajoules. You've had a claim for 6 megajoules of energy to do the goods and services on average that we get with our dollar. Now, if you take the dollars out of our society, it could still exist with trade. It'd be very awkward, but of course, but conceivably it could still exist. But you take the energy out, it would stop tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And so the energy is the reality that runs our economy, and the dollar is the means that we can keep track of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raises a number of strange issues. One is, what happens if the dollar becomes involved in such a state of disorder that the financial system doesn't work very well to lubricate the production of everything else?
Depending on who you are, of course, except it does. I don't quite understand the question, because my dollar, it inflates all the time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that inflation, as we showed in our 1984 paper in Science, inflation can be predicted quite well by the ratio of energy in society to dollars in society. It's gotten a little squirrely now because people are getting dollars because they want the security of the dollar currency versus many other currencies.
Mm-hmm.
So that bids the value of the dollar up, and that's another thing saving our ass today, but that's a different question.
But it does kind of confound the formula that you're speaking of. I mean, we're printing just enormous amounts of money. The amount of money that we're creating, or whether it's money or credit, is really unclear to me. They may be exactly the same thing, but it's gone up kind of exponentially since the beginning of COVID. 19, at least to another order of magnitude. You know, we had a national deficit of about $1 trillion not long ago, and now it's, you know, we're getting into $2 or $3 trillion a year in deficits, and the national debt is going up enormously. How is that not affecting the relationship between energy inputs and our money?
I would have expected at this point hyperinflation, but it hasn't occurred. That's why I mentioned something about people want dollars and that bids its value up. I don't pretend to know everything, and I don't know that very well. But I will say this about debt. Debt, if it is to be honored, also requires 6 megajoules as a backing to each dollar, 6 megajoules of energy as a backing. Incidentally, joules are calories. They're all interconvertible. They're just, I should probably stick to one or the other, but joules is what we're supposed to use in today. Mm-hmm. And so 6 megajoules per dollar. So if, well, let's take the relation, which I thought about some time ago when we were borrowing so much money from Japan. We didn't have inflation because the money was borrowed and was supposedly going to be paid back versus just running the printing presses. That was one way to suppress this hyperinflation, well used by Ronald Reagan, who borrowed far more money than Franklin Roosevelt ever thought about, even correcting for the difference in the value of a dollar. So I don't know. We've gotten into this kind of hyperinflation thing, never paying for it. And so I figured out once that if we were to repay the capital to Japan that we owed them, and they used that money to buy stuff made in the United States, Fords, I don't know why they'd want a Ford, but say Fords or beef or fish or shrimp or whatever they might want to buy from the United States, that for us to produce those physical units, it would drain all of our oil wells just to pay off our debt. So I think we need to, somebody needs to do a really good study of that, because I think we barely understand what this all is, but it's scary.
Hey, let's take a pause to introduce a new sponsor, Sage Restoration, a fine company based out of Ontario, Canada. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. This company specializes in high-quality traditional varnishes, paints, and other products for building preservation. And now a few words from Sage Preservation. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials. But our building history tells us that it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oils and resins to paint and protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that last for decades, that do not trap moisture, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it is our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials and knowledge that have been proven over time, and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit their website at sagerestoration.com. That's one word, sagerestoration.com. KunstlerCast listeners get free shipping on their first order. Use the code KUNSTLER at checkout. You can also look for the Sage Restoration ad in the Eyesore of the Month feature of Kunstler.com. And we thought that might be a helpful counterpoint as an alternative to the eyesores that we all enjoy every month. Seems like you're expressing the idea that we're between a rock and a hard place. There is, after all, a finite supply of petroleum. There seem to be signs that we're reaching that point. We didn't really quite get around to how are we going to run the United States and all of the stuff that we run on alternative energy, namely solar, wind, dark matter, used French fried potato oil, you know, whatever else it is.
We're going to do it, but we're going to probably do much less of it. So there you go.
Okay, well, that gets to another thing, which I think we should talk about, which is that it seems to me the universe is telling us that we're going to have to downscale our activities and get less complex and get more local Can we do that, in your opinion, within the context of biophysical economics? Can we downscale? It also seems to me that such a change is apt to generate a profound political distress and disorder.
In the latter point, it's going to be really tough navigating this, and especially not tough if people don't understand it. So that's why we try to get people to understand it, because, you know, there's some rough seas coming that we haven't even begun to see.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the fires keep burning, the hurricanes keep coming, and the viruses pile up and everything, good Lord, a rocky future is quite a possibility. And I would like to calm the seas and seek a way out that isn't based on craziness. Seems like so much of what people's responses to things that are very understandable from a biophysical perspective and a biophysical economics perspective, most people don't understand it that way. And the left brain blames the right, and the right blames the left, and the up blames the down, and the down blames the up, and whatever. So, but, you know, let's analyze it properly. It can be done. And that's what we're trying to do. Okay, so I'd like to make this point. I wish I'd made it earlier, and then I'm going to try to answer your question. It's a simple point. If you ask the average person, what does economics mean to you? Well, it means food on the table, a roof over their head, maybe a car in the driveway, and maybe whatever they do, go to a sporting game or go out for dinner or whatever. It means material stuff. So why doesn't economics deal with the material reality of the stuff that they are talking about? Well, they don't. And that's why we think we have something powerful to say to everybody who's interested in economics. And incidentally, that we have in a textbook that's called Energy and the Wealth of Nations, published by Springer. It's an introduction to biophysical economics. It's all in there. So it's all laid out very clearly. And then people can read it and make up their own mind. What's left of your question?
Well, how are we going to run America on solar, wind, and used French fry potato oil? Or do we have to really rethink the organization of daily life in America?
Well, I think we have so much wealth that we can, not everybody, mind you, it's very poorly distributed, but there's so much wealth that if we can certainly cut down on a lot of wealth and still be very well off, and that's what we look forward to. How can you do that? I think it's important to get a better biophysical analysis of the economy and ask just that question. For one thing, we can certainly run some things on wind turbines or PVs or something, but they're just a few percentage of all of the energy that we use. And they're also very energy intensive to make, and you've got to use the energy up front. Most of the energy that goes into a wind turbine goes up front into building the capital costs.
Yeah, and that raises the question of whether we need an underlying fossil fuel economy in order to even produce the all-energy stuff.
Absolutely. And to get all the materials, and you know, then there's questions, is there enough copper, is there enough cobalt, is there enough whatever for all of these schemes of the future? So, yes, we need a great deal of fossil fuel. There's arguments as to whether it's worse for the climate to burn coal or to burn natural gas. And there's a lot of issues that are not very well resolved yet. So it's kind of hard to make a path forward. But I certainly think that we can do a lot of intelligent belt tightening and do the things that are important. And I believe healthcare for everybody. And I even go along with the I got educated at mostly at state universities and paid for by somebody else's taxes. And it got me started. And then I went along and became a quote unquote productive member of society based on their original investments in me. And I'd like to see that happen, too. But can we do everything on a shrinking budget? Well, we're going to have to make some hard choices. And how much of our debt are we going to pay back? And when are we going to pay it back? If you start doing this based on energy, your choices become rather more limited. And that's what we have to decide. Look, we've got 20 billion barrels of oil or whatever it is left in the United States. How do you want to spend it? Maybe we should ask our questions that way.
I know that you're acquainted with Gail Tverberg, who writes the blog Our Finite World. Are you acquainted also with Tim Morgan, who writes the Surplus Energy Economics page?
Yeah, I certainly am. And
because I think both of them
would be real careful, because some of his stuff he swiped from me, but he's been very gracious and apologetic about it. And so, okay, yes, I know Tim Morgan. Yes.
Okay, and I'd say that both Gail Tverberg and Tim Morgan would agree with you, or would agree, let's just say agree with each other, that we are in a predicament with this thing called growth. And in fact, we may have entered something that Tim describes as a degrowth economy, a contracting economy. And it may...
Yes, at the moment.
Yeah. It may also be said that economies pulsate like all kinds of other organisms in the universe. You know, they swell and they recede and they grow and they shrink. They're born and then they die. And that is a true condition. But it's possible that this degrowth dynamic may go on for quite a while into the future. It may be quite a long-term thing. How is that going to work with paying back our debts and keeping this level of a technological society going?
Well, obviously, it's going to make it a lot more difficult.
Okay. Does it fit within the paradigm that you work with? And what is it telling us that we're going to have to do if it's true, if it's actually happening?
I've been criticized appropriately for being much better at the analysis than at figuring out a solution. And you know, I don't have a magic wand.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make all this stuff go away. Certainly these climate issues, which, you know, if you ask people what's the most important greenhouse gas, almost everybody gets it wrong. The mm-hmm. most important gas is water vapor, and we don't understand it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that related to the increases of CO2 and all kinds of other things? But let's not go there. I do think there's so many things that seem weird to me that I think we got to pay attention, a lot of attention, to not trying to put too much CO2 in the atmosphere if we can help it. I do think to try to make a stable society is a really good idea. I have no children myself because I figured this out back when I was 20 and, you know, didn't want to contribute to all of this stuff. So, and I'm perfectly happy without children. I suppose if I had them, I'd love them to death, but I don't miss them. I can tell you that. So I had other things I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, that's part of what we need to do around the world. Give especially women the option for other things to do with their life other than staying home as a slave and having babies. And hopefully the children that are born will be very much wanted, et cetera. And there are, instead of being, oh, God, another one. And so, yeah, there's a lot that we could do from on this. And I would hope that we're going to do it, but it doesn't seem like we can possibly do it fast enough to catch up with what's probably coming down the pike. I don't have a good answer other than to say to educate our children to biophysical reality and to the fact that we're not going to have more oil forever. In fact, we may not have it ever again. And that the transition to whatever is next is not going to be easy or cheap, and it's going to take a whole lot of whatever oil and gas and even coal that we've got left, not to mention many materials. And so we need a new kind of teaching starting in high school with the reality, the biophysical reality of the world, and not feed them fairy tales like you get out of conventional economics.
If the biophysical realities of our economy are pointing towards a necking down of fossil fuels in one way or another, and of other things like ores and timber and other resources for now anyway. What does that say to you about possibly entering a period of capital scarcity?
Well, you mean capital money or capital real things?
Well, actually, let's parse that out a little, because how much of the capital out there is actually real? It seems that an awful lot of it is vested in things of dubious value. You know, shares in companies that don't show profits, junk bonds, janky derivatives, currencies that are being badly abused by central banks. How much of that capital is notional and how much of it is actually real capital? I think that's a big question for us.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Okay. I don't have anything to add to that. I don't know. The finances are mysterious and people are making an awful lot of money without making stuff. But on the other hand, our industrial society, compared to when my father was born in 1908, is so unbelievably productive. You know, 2% of Americans can feed the other 98% plus other people around the world.
For now.
For now, because the industrial society, at least from the immediate perspective, not counting pollutional problems, et cetera, but the industrial society is so bloody productive. It used to be that 80 to 90% of Americans had to be farmers just so that all of us could be fed. Now 2% of us are farmers. We have an enormous amount of surplus wealth from the process of using fossil fuels to run our economy. And I don't think that it's going to be very easy at all to get alternatives to replace them. Wind turbines look the best to me that we know of at the moment, but we're trying to understand all of these things using various metrics like energy return on investment to get some idea of what the possibilities might be. I'm not a catastrophist and I'm not an optimist. I'm somewhere in between. You know, we went through all this, Jim, when the limits to growth first came out. Many of us, when we were in graduate school, thought, you know, the world was going to come tumbling down. And then we had the oil crisis of 73 and 79. And it seemed to us like, in fact, that it would. And so we went around beating our breasts and talking about, you know, the end of all this stuff. And then it all kind of worked itself out. Now, do I think it's all going to kind of work itself out, given all of the difficulties of today? Well, some of it will, some of it won't. I'm not quite ready yet to be a Cassandra, but I am a great believer in there are limits to what we can do. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we want to talk about is there are limits to growth, and we need to take that concept and even the study, which looks pretty good by now, it looks pretty accurate in describing the future. From back there in 1970, we got to think about those things very carefully. Yeah, most people don't know that the world has reached peak oil, the real stuff, genuine oil, not natural gas liquids and all biofuels and all this other crap they throw in there, somewhere around 2005. Mm-hmm. And it's 6 of 8 continents have reached peak oil, clearly, and some 38 of 44 oil-producing countries have reached peak oil. It's a real thing. Mm-hmm. It's happening. And it's hammering all kinds of economies in Latin America and Colombia and Venezuela, in Argentina and other places around the world, Algeria and even Libya conceivably, and so forth. This is something that's been analyzed very well by a guy named Nafiz Ahmed.
Yeah, I've encountered him.
He's got a really, really good book. Just put in Ahmed, A-H-M-E-D, and collapsing, and get it by his book. It's a fantastic insight. You know, Syria and Egypt, they're still there. There's still people there. There's still economies there. But it's things are pretty rough because they've reached their peak oil and are well on their slide down the other side.
They've also had trouble with agricultural production and the size of their population and all that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, what do you do with a tremendous population numbers and steel growth in Egypt, and you don't have diesel to pump oil out of the Nile onto the fields? Well, what do you do?
I don't know. Although Syria is nowhere near the Nile.
Well, yeah, but, you know, Syria had a pretty good economy before they reached their peak around the year 2000, I think. And most countries in the world that produce oil have had peak oil, just following right along after the Hubbard model, just like Hubbard said. And just the really big ones, Russia and Saudi Arabia, of course, and a few other Arabian places, and until this last year, the United States, that kept global oil production from falling.
And now, a word from our other fine sponsor, David McIlvaney's ICM Wealth Management. It's been a wild month for gold, went way up past its 2011 high, is retreating right now, and we should regard that as a wonderful buying opportunity. Because times are only going to be getting weirder in this election season, and gold and silver are very important hedges in a time of political disorder. There are two proven and effective strategies for compounding ounces in your precious metals portfolio without putting more money in. But there's only one company you'll find that has been advising clients in these strategies and doing so for over 30 years. McIlvaney ICA advises you on and manages your precious metals holdings and will not let you get started in dead-end products. Instead, your personal advisor will make sure your portfolio is set up for free ounce accumulation strategies as the markets change and keep you informed on when to make a move. This can also be easily done within your IRA. Call 1-800-525-9556 for a free report to learn more, or go to icagoldcompany.com to download the PDF. By the way, I'm also a big fan of David McIlvaney's podcast, the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, which is truly among the best on the web and gives you a great snapshot of David's generous personality. And now back to the podcast. Well, I want to ask you kind of a pure science question, which has to do with biophysical realities, but it's a little abstruse. Where does entropy do its most insidious work in our financial system?
Well,
you laugh.
You know, I have some arguments with some of my colleagues because I don't think entropy is an important thing.
Okay, tell us why.
Well, it's an awkward word, but negentropy. What's important is the structures we produce for living, and this is true for a fish. Speaking as a biologist, I studied this a lot in fish. This is true for a fish. A fish produces energy to live, but it goes out there, a trout goes out there and eats mayflies and turns the mayflies into trout flesh and into trout activity and the energy to do whatever it takes to be a trout, and it generates entropy in so doing. So mm-hmm. What? A refrigerator uses energy to maintain the structure of the tuna fish sandwich that you have in the refrigerator. In so doing, it pumps heat out the back. Put your hand on the back of a refrigerator, it's warm. That's the heat it's generating in order to maintain the order of your refrigerator. What's important? The heat coming out the back? No. What's important is the order that you make. Entropy is a tax that nature puts on you for maintaining order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've got too much entropy, that is, if you don't have enough electricity or oil to make the electricity or whatever it is to run your society, then entropy indeed is waiting in the wings. So you're over time, the structure of your economy, your bridges will fall into the rivers as they did in Minneapolis. If you don't make the investments to maintain your infrastructure. Mm-hmm. If you stop eating, you know, you'll die. And so the question isn't whether entropy is there. Of course it's there. The important thing is how much order can you create given the resources and the ideas at your disposal.
I have a hunch that we're probably not going to be returning to an industrial production model a la 1960, rather something much more humble, perhaps shockingly so. What does Charlie Hall make of what American life will look like 25 years from now?
Well, I'm 77. I'm unlikely to be alive. If you're still alive and you figure it out and you can figure out the address, you can send me a postcard.
Well, I'm not that far behind you, Charlie. I'll be trout fishing with you on whatever that great river in the sky is up there.
It depends on how we deal with these biophysical realities. I think we can have a perfectly good life. I'm not sure it's going to be quite like what I read in your marvelous first few books, or maybe second and third books or whatever they were, about living in the Hudson Valley with the collapse of the industrial system. That's one alternative it might be. It wouldn't surprise me, but I think more likely it's going to be similar to today and less affluent.
Mm-hmm.
I think we might be running at, say, 70% of the affluence of today. Well, I think we can easily tighten our belts that much. People may not want to do it. I mean, people are tightening their belts now. They're not going out to eat, and other than a small number of people dying from the virus, they're not dying like flies. So we've reduced our energy use by, I don't know, 10 or 20% in the United States. And we're continuing along. We're doing fine. Many of us are doing fine. We're just less affluent. Don't go out to fancy restaurants so much and don't go to big football games. And we've cut off, like my parents would tell me during the Great Depression, you know, that they lived pretty much as they did before, but there was an awful lot less money to go around, real money to go around. That would be my best guess, is that we're not going to likely be richer and we're likely to be somewhat poorer. But the question is, will it be enormously poorer? And unless we have some kind of political collapse, which is possible, I don't think so. I think, and this in my mind makes the question of how you distribute the money. So long the question of distribution has been bought off by saying, oh, well, you know, that everybody will be, the society will be richer. And even though the rich keep their percentage of it, the poor will get a little bit more too. Well, I think we can't do that anymore. And I think we got to talk a lot about redistribution. When I was a young kid doing my paper route in Hingham, Massachusetts in the fourth grade, and I looked at so this is 1950 something, early 50s, and I happened to look at the Boston Globe, and it says that the tax rate on the wealthy was 85 or 90%, whatever it said. And I remember looking at that as a kid and thinking, well, that sounds fair. They got a lot more money. They should pay more taxes. Now the rich pay less as a percentage than the poor do, mm-hmm. or the middle class. So there's been enormous changes in the tax rate since the 1950s. And I feel that one of the most important things to do is to go back to what I consider to be a fairer tax rate. I know that's a politically explosive thing, but that you've asked me, and that's what I think.
But there it is. Well, speaking of redistributing wealth, what do you make of so-called modern monetary theory and the policies associated with it, like the universal basic income and the ability of a sovereign state to print as much of its currency as it likes to?
Well, I don't know that I have much of a say in it. I do think that there should be a minimum income, but we don't want to remove incentives to work, for sure. I don't think we want to do that. We don't want to generate a so-called well, I believe in a welfare state in some respects, like, say, I don't know, modern Sweden, I might be comfortable with that, I don't know. We don't want to pay people not to work. That makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, we want to make sure that children are getting a decent diet and decent education, et cetera. So it's a complicated issue, but I would certainly lean in that as to whether countries can print as much money as they want. Well, they're doing it. It's funny how all these Republicans have become Keynesians. It's just crazy.
Well, you said yourself that you had expected hyperinflation as a result of all this and hasn't happened. You want to go back and see if you can explain why that hasn't happened?
Well, I mean, I have to say partly I don't know. Mm. And partly it's because when the world is unstable, everybody wants to buy dollars, and dollars, like anything else, does respond to supply and demand. That much economics I believe in. And so they bid up the value of the dollar. And so I don't know. I do think that people who are getting hammered, not through their fault, by this virus, I would like a safety net for them. Mm-hmm. Be willing to pay some of my own money towards that. Raise taxes on me. That's okay.
Well, there's already been an awful lot of destruction in terms of small businesses and people's livelihoods.
Well, these are very complicated issues, but I do think we've been sold such a bill of goods that free enterprise is going to indefinitely create wealth. And free enterprise has indefinitely created wealth for the people who are pulling the levers. But they haven't indefinitely created the wealth for everybody. And even though most people are engaged in the process, i.e. are necessary, apparently, for making that wealth. And so it strikes me as that there's something unfair that's going on big time. Mm-hmm. And that I think most Americans would like to some degree, redress this. Exactly how you do it and by what mechanisms and what political parties and whatever, that I have to say, well, I leave that up to the democratic process, which one thing I say in all this craziness that's been going on in the last few years, I studied a lot the founding fathers and the constitutions and so forth when I was in college. And I was really impressed then, and I'm really impressed now. Mm-hmm. That our Constitution is a wonderful thing, and let's make sure that we hold everyone accountable to that and all the standards of honesty. That is really important.
I've only got one more question for you, and I think we'll wrap it up then. What about a timeout from all the high-tech progress that we've been ramming through for the last 200 years? Might we benefit from a period of reflection on what we've been doing and perhaps on the insults that we've subjected our home planet to? Would that maybe be not a bad thing to kick back for a few decades or maybe a century, maybe a little more, and kind of figure out where we've been and what we've been doing during this orgy of progress?
Well, I haven't talked very much about protecting the Earth, and that's probably first in my own sense of what we need to do. For me, that's just a given. And I don't think, Jim, we can quote unquote stop progress, but maybe we need to regulate it a lot more. I don't think having ever better video games is necessarily the end result of the desired end result of human existence. And I think it would, if we can generate a society in which more people are gainfully employed in generating food and other necessities of life and can have a sense of dignity in that process, the idea that we produce all of our food with 2% of us in gigantic oil-guzzling machines, to me, is crazy. We need a lot more people doing agriculture one way or another, I think.
Yeah.
I think we've got to relax our pressure on the environment. Yeah, sure, I would love to. I don't see any particular virtue in most of the technological changes, although, you know, I can look at you on my computer screen. That's pretty amazing, I have to admit. Nobody's going to ask me to stop technology. I'm probably not going to think about it very much because I don't think we're going to do it. But we're doing what we can do, Jim. I'm working with a bunch of people, mostly from the financial and industrial world, to generate a new biophysical economics institute.
Yeah, can you tell us about that and what that effort is about and where people can find out about it on the web?
Well, we're not quite launched. I think it will be in a matter of a month or two. Anybody can write me anytime, unless it gets ridiculous, at Charles at C-Hall, C-H-A-L-L, at ESF.edu. Okay. ESF, Environmental Science and Forestry.edu. That's my old academic address. And anyone can write me and ask me about this or whatever else or what they might read. But we want to put all kinds of resources for finding out things at the most basic level and at the most sophisticated level about biophysical economics, about energy return on investment, which is our critical tool, which we haven't talked about very much, but what is your energy return for a unit of energy invested in various energy technologies? And, you know, what is the progress? And, you know, we're seeking, we think we've got some ideas for some deep pockets lined up, but anybody out there who would like to contribute to this effort, we would certainly welcome and appreciate your contribution. And we need some skilled people in time to do the things that need to be done. But most importantly, we need just teaching. It's not that difficult. It's just that all of our economists have been toilet trained in one way of economics. Why should you go and take a course in economics in university that neglects all the other courses that are out there, then chemistry and physics and geology and everything else that are out there that tell you about what the world is really like? So the first thing we need to do is to make sure that our economists are well trained in the realities of the world. And we think we've laid it out pretty straightforwardly and that that can be done. And we want to make all of this information available to anybody who can read English at various levels of sophistication and provide tools for teaching and so forth. And we, ideally, if we get well funded, all of this would be made free to be available to universities. So, I mean, we teach a million young people a year basic neoclassical economics, which essentially is a series of fairy tales. That's the first place to start, at least in my opinion.
Well, Charlie, I've been to quite a number of your conferences over the years and met a lot of your colleagues, and they're good, smart people. And I'll look forward to your success in putting this institute online together and making it happen. And maybe we'll check back in with you in the 2021, which is liable to be a pretty raucous year, too. In the meantime, have an interesting fall, as we all will, and we will ride again.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate this chance, Jim. You ask good questions, and I say to all of you who are following this that just don't leave your brains behind when you go study economics.
Okay.
Don't leave your common sense behind. Okay.
Thanks, Charlie.